It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Saturday, January 28th, 2023. I'm Kevin Cork. A change at the White House that could both retool and reinvigorate the Biden agenda.
I think Klein made a decision. 2023 is about setting up the presidential reelect in 24 and relentlessly depicting the Republicans as MAGA extremists. And Zients, I think, is smart enough to say, you know what? We are better off focusing on governing and getting whatever bipartisan cooperation we can in 2023.
I'm Ryan Schmelz. After airline cancellations rocked the United States over the holidays, some are calling for more competition when it comes to transportation, but those pushing for more rail options are running into their own set of issues.
The challenge they're going to face right now is making a system that people actually want to take because it gets you to where you want to go. It's not clear that's what it's doing right now.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. It's a rite of passage in Washington. Once the midterms are over, there are usually changes aplenty over at the White House, even among senior staff. And this year is no different, with Chief of Staff Ron Klain set to step down. But as COVID Response Team Coordinator Jeff Zients prepares to man the helm, he does so against fierce political headwinds. Zients will step in at a time of great uncertainty at the White House, with the classified documents drama, the looming budget battle, and a debt crisis among the many pressing issues facing a president who's still looking to be his party's standard bearer in 2024. So where to begin? And what exactly does the chief of staff do? We ask a man who'd know.
Well, they're responsible for the day-to-day management of the West Wing.
Former Deputy White House Chief of Staff and Special Advisor to former President George W. Bush, Karl Rove.
They are an expression of the president. Not everything needs to end up on the president's desk. And when they end up on the president's desk, when issues go into the Oval, the Chief of Staff has the responsibility of making certain that they're fully prepared, that everybody who should have a whack at the issue has had a whack, that the material is presented to the president in a way that he or she can grasp it easily, and that all the viewpoints are appropriately represented, and then once the president makes a decision, that it's executed. And the chief of staff is also literally the person who all the major people in the White House report to him, whether it's the communications chief, the speech writers, the legislative people, you know, the political people, the finance people, the deputy chief of staff, you know, all of those report to the chief of staff. Now, some of them also have direct reports with special provisions directly to the president, but he's the person who's got his finger on the pulse of how the West Wing is going and making certain that all the trains are running on time and that everybody is pushing for the president's agenda.
What really makes this an excellent opportunity for a conversation is, in part, because you have been a senior advisor to a president. You've worked in an administration at the very highest levels. I'm just curious if you feel like his role, if Zients is, of course, elevated as we expect, would be outsized, say, compared to your experience with Andy Card while you were in the White House.
Well, I think that's yet to be determined. What's easy to say, though, is that Ron Klain's experience is outsized. I mean, for example, he was clearly the political chief in the White House. I was the senior advisor in charge of the politics, but that seems to be something that he largely was involved in. He took major responsibilities in terms of legislative liaison. There's a person who's, in essence, the White House lobbyist in charge of legislative affairs. But Klain was constantly in communications with key allies on the Hill, not just simply Schumer and in the Senate and Pelosi in the House, but also with more junior members, particularly the progressive caucus in the House. He made certain that he held their hand in order to keep them from getting off the reservation. He was also the comms director because he was constantly messaging what the White House message was. He was also the tweeter in chief. You know, he would start tweeting early in the morning until late at night. So Zients would be smart to say, you know what, we're entering potentially a presidential election year, and so I shouldn't be charged with all of these things. And, for example, it would be smart to have somebody whose job it is to be the liaison with and superintend the campaign. That was my job. One of my jobs in 2004 was to, in essence, be the point of contact with the campaign. And so the various members of the White House staff were not constantly in communications with the campaign. They came to me, and then, you know, I was the funnel. Actually, my deputy, Susan Ralston, was literally called the funnel to make certain that everything inside the White House was communicated to the campaign in a uniform way, not piecemeal, and everything was communicated back. So that's one thing that he ought to do. And I think he ought to give up the tweeter-in-chief responsibility. I think this was one of the things that ill-served the White House. It's one thing to have somebody doing social media. It's another thing to have the White House chief of staff opining on things big and small all day long. He's got a more important job than to sit down and write tweets.
I couldn't agree more, and I feel like one of the big misses, swings and misses for Ron Klain was he didn't come across as empathetic, and I think that can really bite you when you are the tone setter, particularly when you're using social media, and it did on a couple of occasions. Let me ask you about some of the major challenges facing Zients on day one. Obviously, docudrama with the classified documents. There's the brewing and unfortunately escalating circumstance in Ukraine, the ongoing border crisis, the crime crisis. Carl, I really feel like that's an overlooked story to a large extent in the mainstream media. I think that's something else he may have to deal with on day one, and the economy, and yes, 2024. So of those major challenges, I guess I threw in a sixth, which do you think most urgently needs to be dealt with?
Well, first, I'd put two more on that list. I'd put the debt ceiling, which is coming here rather quickly, and then the budget. I mean, think about it. We are running the largest financial enterprise in the world. It's called the U.S. government. And the beginning of the fiscal year was last October 1st, and we did not have a budget in place and for months after it began. You know, it's unbelievable how ill-prepared we are to run the mechanics of the government. And it's been going on for years, and we better stop it. And then the debt ceiling is going to be an issue. It was one thing if you had a Democrat House and a Democrat Senate, and you had to raise the budget ceiling. You know, look, when we had a Republican House and Republican Senate, we raised the budget. We raised the debt ceiling. When we had a Democrat Congress, the Democrat House said, we want concessions before we have the debt ceiling raised. Well, the Republicans now have the House, and they're going to want concessions. And one of the things that I was critical of in my Wall Street Journal piece about Ron Klain is he is highly political and significantly more liberal than his boss. And while he says he's for bipartisan cooperation, he rarely engages in it. And he's made the White House harder edged than it should be, even when it serves no good purpose. And the attacks, for example, on the Republicans as being extremists on the budget. And like on Monday, the White House press secretary went out and said, quote, House Republicans are using their narrow majority to force the American people to pay higher gas prices. Well, what in the hell does that mean? That's ridiculous. And that kind of stupid statement coming from the White House briefing podium could not have happened unless Ron Klain greenlit it. And I thought it was worthy of some, you know, low-ranking congressional comms aide, not the White House. But with divided government, if you're going to get something done, one of the things Zients can do is lower the rhetoric. It does him no good to go out and allow his principal, the president, and White House staff to routinely bash the Republicans when you're trying to get past an important moment like we have here with the debt ceiling and the budget. Better to try and find, you know, tell the American people you want to find common ground and try and find it, and then be critical if the other side doesn't want to let you have it.
There are those, Carl, who say that Klain, like him or not, is perhaps the canary in the coal mine. What do you make of that suggestion? He's getting off the ship at a crucial time, and yet there are those who feel like, again, in their circles, in their bubble, Ron Klain was a winner. Ron Klain was successful. Yeah. Ron Klain was the real pugilist, and they feel like he's going to be well-positioned for 2024, no matter who the party's standard-bearer is. And yet there is a suggestion among some here who feel like this guy's the canary in the coal mine. He's hitting the bricks, and there will be many, many more like him in the days and months ahead. What say you?
Yeah. Well, I think it was great stage managing, because you're right. The president has momentum, and I'm leaving when he's in a good place. We avoided a wipeout in the elections. Well, you lost the House, buddy. Mm. And, you know, as far as the president, yes, there was a brief upswing after the election. But since early January, when the documents began to, when the DocuGate started emerging, with the drama on him having classified documents after having criticized President Trump by saying it was totally irresponsible, the president's job approval is declining. The Real Clear Politics average was 42.4, and while that might, you know, might go up a little bit after the State of the Union, it's been falling since January 5th, and I suspect it will continue to go down. And not only that, but the president's problem with DocuGate is going to grow. Last week, the ABC poll found that 77% believe Donald Trump, quote, acted inappropriately in handling classified files, and 64% thought the same of Mr. Biden. And that was before we learned this weekend that there were even more materials stored in his Delaware home. So, 66% of independents believe that he acted inappropriately in handling classified files. So I think you're right. Mr. Klain may be fleeing just in time. I think the president's approval is in a lousy place. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. And I think it's going to get worse. And the president's standing because of how he's handled classified documents is pitiful. And I think going to get worse. The delta between the percentage that think that Trump acted irresponsibly and those that think that Biden acted irresponsibly, I think is going to narrow to the disadvantage of President Biden. He's, the number of people who think he did a bad thing is going to grow.
I want to touch on 2024, but before I do, do you think Zients will pull the plug on KJP? Listen, it's never an easy job to be the press secretary. There is a stark contrast, I think it certainly could be argued, between when she does the briefings and when others step in to do the briefing. Do you think that experiment's over?
I don't know. I doubt it. I think we're more likely to see him make changes in the tone and demeanor of the briefings. That is to say, rather than simply saying, I refer you to my colleagues in the counsel's office, I suspect that we'll start seeing, if Zients is smart, he'll start putting the counsel's office out there to answer the questions, because she's doing a lousy job of it, and certainly they could do better. And I think he may also say, you know what, I don't want you out there, you know, doing things like blaming high gas prices on House Republicans and having the energy secretary join you for 30 minutes to do nothing but beat up on the House Republicans. They've got important work to do. I think Klain made a decision. 2023 is about setting up the presidential reelect in 24 and relentlessly depicting the Republicans as MAGA extremists. And Zients, I think, is smart enough to say, you know what, we are better off focusing on governing and getting whatever bipartisan cooperation we can in 2023, leave the trash talking to the Democratic National Committee, at least to the fall, and have the president be the president as long as we possibly can have him do so. There's no need for him to go out and create a campaign in the spring and summer of 2023. He's better off being the president and letting the Republicans be the sort of the political circus going on out there.
Yeah, I'm frankly surprised at the tone and tenor from the podium. Usually that's a policy spot with just a tinge of, you know, this is what we're doing. You want to talk about this? We want to talk about that. But it's become a nonstop barrage of partisan, hyperpartisanship. Certainly that's been the criticism here in Washington. And I'm not so sure it served the White House well. They might argue that this is the only way, Kevin, because everything has changed. It's not like it used to be. But I think there's certainly an argument that could be made that maybe it hasn't been as effective as perhaps they would have liked. A question for you, Karl Rove, our great guest. On 2024, there is a bit of chatter, if you'll indulge me, that maybe Joe Biden is not the party's standard bearer. I'm not so sure they have any options out there unless, you know, George Clooney or Michelle Obama decides to surprise everybody. I think he may be the horse they have to bet on. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, look, first of all, let me say something. Michelle Obama hates politics.
Yeah.
The last thing she wants to do is be a candidate. And she knows that if she were ever to entertain the idea of a political career, which would frankly make her physically ill, the notion of it, but she's smart enough to know that if she was ever to want to run for vice president or president, that people would say Brock is trying to get a third term. I mean, this is lunacy. Just stop talking about it. I have been saying for more than a year that I think there's a very large chance that Joe Biden will not be the nominee of the Democratic Party. First of all, he's not doing well. He's flailing and failing, and we know it. We see it on the screen every time he talks. And the notion that the American people or the oldest political party in America is going to nominate an 82-year-old to run for president and hope that he's still alive and functioning at 86 with a running mate who has worse numbers than he does, Kamala Harris, is they're not that dumb. And look, think about all the people out there who want to run. Governor Murphy of New Jersey, Governor Cooper of North Carolina, Governor Whitmer of Michigan, Governor Pritzker of Illinois, Amy Klobuchar, Newsom. Senator Cory Booker, Governor Polis of Colorado, Governor Newsom of California, Mitch Landrieu, the infrastructure chief and former mayor of New Orleans and lieutenant governor of Louisiana. And I'm confident I've left out other names. But they got a lot of people over there. Marianna Williamson, who, remember, lasted much longer along with Joaquin Castro than Kamala Harris did in 2020, is already heading to New Hampshire. And then Pete Buttigieg, who's in the president's cabinet. So I just don't think – I think the country is in a place like it was in 1960. It said, you know, we have an admirable president. His name is Dwight Eisenhower. But he was born before the turn of the 20th century. And we want to pick from one of the two young combat veterans of the Pacific Theater in World War II, the two 40-year-olds, JFK and Richard Nixon. And the country for the next 32 years was led by somebody from what we call the greatest generation. Well, for 32 years, we've been led by somebody who is a baby boomer, or in the case of Biden, somebody older than a baby boomer. He's from what we call the silent generation. And I think the country's ready for a turn. And his performance in the office, I think, is only making people more interested in it.
I'm glad you mentioned all those interested parties. I know Gavin Newsom. it's almost funny. In a way, to me, it's funny because you can kind of just see it. It's kind of like seeping out of every, you know, every
exactly.
pore
every
in his
pore.
Body, how badly he wants to be the
look,
person.
Look, I know why you're down on him, though. I know why you're down on him. He's got better hair than you and me both.
Yeah, well, he does have better than you and me, right? It is always a pleasure. Former White House Deputy Chief of Staff, Senior Advisor to President George W. Bush, and, of course, the great architect, Karl Rove, joining us here. Karl, thank you so much, and continued success. We'll talk real soon.
Great. Thank you. All the best.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
In the heart of the holiday travel cycle, winter weather led to thousands of flights being canceled, and over 50% of them were Southwest Airlines flights, leaving thousands of travelers and employees stranded across the country. The frustrations have given those advocating for rail a reason to continue their push for expansion. One project from Texas Central Railway is trying to get off the ground, which would build a high-speed rail connecting Dallas and Houston. Back in the 90s, a similar bullet train project in Texas collapsed for multiple reasons. Many believe a big one was intense lobbying by Southwest Airlines. While the company doesn't seem to have taken a public stance on the latest project, high-speed rail faces plenty of other challenges when it comes to getting on the right track.
The United States has an interesting history with intercity passenger rail.
Brookings Metro non-resident and senior fellow and Eno Center for Transportation president and CEO Robert Puentes joins us to talk about the current state and future of rail.
Most of it is dominated by Amtrak, which is an extensive system that goes coast to coast. Most of it, the vast majority of it, actually operates on the lines of private freight railroads. It's really only between Washington, D.C. and Boston where Amtrak operates on dedicated corridors. So for the most part, it's a tale of three systems. There's the Northeast Corridor, there's the transcontinental routes, and then there are state-supported routes. But it's generally an effective system where there is the right kind of investment, where there are cities that people want to travel between, and where the distances are about the right for passenger rail to be functioning.
Now, President Biden was actually confronted by a protester when he was in Kentucky for a visit recently, and the protester was pretty passionate about commuter rail or just forms of public transit as opposed to a highway system or other systems like that where we, you know, transfer by car. You know, and I believe I read an article that you were quoted in recently talking about how the infrastructure bill didn't really more focused on maintenance of current rail systems like Amtrak, like you mentioned. You know, do you feel like the infrastructure bill was maybe a missed opportunity to develop more rail systems such as high-speed rail?
We've talked a lot about high-speed rail in recent years, and there have been several attempts to jumpstart those systems in places like California, in places like Texas, in places like Florida. The infrastructure bill was an opportunity to invest in infrastructure all across the board, so not just transportation, but clean energy, broadband, and things like that. The challenge we have with high-speed rail in this country is actually trying to figure out where is it going to go. We have a very built-out transportation system, and it's not an if-you-build-it-they-will-come kind of scenario. It has to connect up places where there is an economic connection, right? So it's got to be places like in California between Los Angeles and San Francisco. It's a perfect corridor. It's about the right distance. It's all within one state. There's an economic connection between them. But we've seen the challenges that they've had trying to build California high-speed rail today. So there might have been an opportunity to jumpstart some high-speed rail, but we've really got to figure out how we're going to get this done and what the implementation plans would look like in these places, because the track record in recent years has shown just how difficult it is to do it, even within one state.
And can we focus quickly on that track record, too? Obviously, California had probably one of the most notable, ambitious high-speed rail plans. You know, what kind of issues did they face, and are they still facing in getting those projects off the ground?
The big challenge we have in this country is that high-speed rail demands there to be a right-of-way or property between two places, right? It sounds like an obvious thing, but it's a challenge in this country, especially because we have a lot of adherence to land rights and property ownership and things like that. So land has to be acquired. It has to be straight. It's got to be pretty flat. And so, you know, all that gets very complex. And if when you start to get into major cities and major metros, the land gets more expensive. I think a lot of that is pretty obvious, but we don't think about just how hard it is to assemble all that land. And so in California is a great example where I have no doubt that if we had a system between downtown San Francisco and downtown Los Angeles, that it would be very effective and super competitive. The challenge is, how do you get it into those cities? And so right now, California High-Speed Rail, the plan is to stop short of that and really just focus on the Inland Empire between Bakersfield and then up north into the near San Francisco. So once that's built, the idea, I think, is that, well, if that's successful, then we'll build a little more. We'll build a little more. We'll get it actually into those cities. But the challenge they're going to face right now is making a system that people actually want to take because it gets you to where you want to go. It's not clear that's what it's doing right now.
And now kind of transitioning into what's going on in Texas right now, kind of what's the state of this Texas Central project to build a rail line from Houston to Dallas? And it's supposed to, you know, only be about a 90-minute train ride to get from one place to another. What's kind of the status on that?
Yeah, I think the Texas High-Speed Rail project between Houston and Dallas would be a great project. Again, it's two major metros where there's clearly a connection. It's a good distance. It's all within one state. But we've seen the challenges that they've had trying to get that going. A lot of it is because of land acquisition. They really can't get the right-of-way, I think, right now that they need to lay down those tracks, to lay down all the infrastructure. It's, you know, it's an intensive project. So, and I'm not 100% sure what the status is now. I think they were supposed to break ground in 2017, 2018. That didn't happen. I think it was supposed to be 2020. That hasn't happened. I believe the estimates are still they're going to have something by 2026. It's hard to imagine that they're going to hit those deadlines, not just because of where they are now, but just the challenges that we have of building this kind of infrastructure in the United States. It always seems to take longer. It always seems to cost more. So it's not 100% clear what the timeline is for that project right now.
And is this a project that's possibly still possible to happen, or is this something that could just fade off and become a missed opportunity?
It's certainly possible that it can happen. You know, the company that's putting it together needs to, if we need to know more information about kind of where they are now, what are the impediments before we can actually assess, you know, whether it's possible or not. But there's no reason why we can't do it. It's just illustrative of all of the impediments that are in the way for an ambitious project like this. Acquiring land, finding the money, doing it in a timely way, having the workforce to do it, and aligning the political leadership along this corridor that's behind it so you can actually get it done and bypass, or at least address some of the opposition that's there, because once these projects get delayed by things other than construction delays, things like the political machine, it really does start to gum up the works and make it very difficult to deliver projects on time.
Right. And getting into that political machine, I'm happy you brought that up, because one of the critics we've seen of this project seems to be some lobbyists for Southwest Airlines who've kind of argued against the project. You know, how does that kind of play in here, and how the airline industry has been in opposition to some of these rail projects?
Yeah, Southwest Airlines has famously lobbied against Texas high-speed rail. I think it was in the 80s and the 90s, mostly because they were operating in this Texas triangle between Dallas and Houston, you know, Austin, San Antonio, kind of that triangle there. And it was very effective. It kind of gets to what we were just talking about, that whether or not their specific lobbying efforts shut down the projects, I don't think it did, but it certainly delayed it for a while and really messed up financing and politics and ambition and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I think that there's clearly an area where we can see airlines and rail coexist. I don't think that since Southwest is mostly focused as a leisure airline and high-speed rail is probably going to be more oriented towards business, you can see areas where these two markets actually work together. But we should have competition in our transportation system, and people should have more abilities to get between places other than just one single mode. So we subsidize all kinds of different transportation modes in this country. Actually, all of the transportation modes are pretty much subsidized. And so we should not have these impediments. We should figure out ways for everything to work together and give people more options for how they get around.
Right. And I think one of the reasons why we wanted to do this episode today is because Southwest lobbying efforts kind of became a little more brought out into the open by advocates because of the recent issues with Southwest Airlines and their little debacle that went down in terms of transportation during the holiday season. You know, do you think that issues like that, when that happens with the airline industry, that kind of brings up a public demand for more competition in the transportation sector?
I think the challenge that Southwest had at the end of last year should create that question about why we don't have options and competition for how we get around and how we get between places. I also think that, you know, we have short memories when it comes to transportation in this country. And if there are modes that are functioning cheaply, effectively, and conveniently, that people are going to take whatever meets those goals. And Southwest has always, you know, had a very fast and cheap way to get around. It's this area around predictability where they fell apart at the end of last year. So, you know, if they can put all that back together, I think that the short memories will take over. But it shouldn't, because we should have conversations in this country about competition, about options, and about choices for how we travel.
And what's been their main effort, or what's been their main argument against rail systems, particularly in Texas?
I don't know that there's been that intense lobbying lately. It may have been, but I think in the 80s and 90s, it was because they were afraid of losing market share to rail that was operating in these corridors. Southwest had a very unique model, a very unique business plan for the places that they were going to serve. And we've seen in other countries and in Europe and in China and other places that these short distance routes, you know, around 400, 500 miles between places where there are economic connections, that rail can be heavily competitive. And so, you know, you can understand from their perspective that they don't want to lose market share. But then there really needs to be a policy conversation from government and from other folks, making sure that Americans do have the kind of options that they need for traveling. I don't know how much of a threat high-speed rail presents to airlines right now, given that we don't have these systems in place, and it's going to be many, many years before we do. You would think between now and then, companies like Southwest would be able to figure out the problems that they experienced at the end of 2022 and fix those pretty quickly.
And how does the politics kind of play in here? Can it be politically effective to want to lobby for high-speed rail? And do you think this is something that lawmakers can get behind, or is it something that's kind of still off there?
I think there's clearly places where we've seen political leadership in supporting rail all across the country. Amtrak, by its very nature, has existed since the early 1970s because of the political bedfellows that have kept it alive. Amtrak was basically created to fail in the 1970s, and it hadn't, because people recognized that you want to have options in places, even in rural states where Amtrak really provides that kind of lifeline, because they may not have airline operations. They may be isolated and maybe too far to drive. And so Amtrak really does represent that kind of connection to other places. And so in the Intermountain West and in the Southeast, you've had that political support for a number of years. But then you look at the Northeast Corridor, where awful lot of political support for Amtrak and for rail, because they see the role that it plays in keeping these places economically competitive. An awful lot of demand for rail in the Northeast between New York and Washington, D.C., for example, where there's a higher market share of people taking the train than flying, for example. And then you have places, you have states like Virginia, North Carolina, Maine, Washington State, where they have really incorporated rail into their overall statewide transportation plans because they recognize that it's a mode that actually can serve the public very well. So there's no doubt that there's political support for it. When it comes to the competition between rail and airlines, it gets down to who's really lobbying these politicians more. But again, I don't think there should be this natural exclusion of one mode over another, but there's clearly ways that they can all work together and coexist.
And what's kind of what do you think that some of these other states can learn from Amtrak? You know, Amtrak's been kind of a trademark when it comes to the rail industry for so long, especially when it comes to commuter traffic or even leisure traffic. You know, what do you think other states can learn about it, about how that's been able to stay effective and stay afloat for all these years?
Amtrak really works best when it is incorporated within overall state plans for transportation. In some places where it comes through major metros, you know, once a day or in the middle of the night, it's hard to see how that's really going to be a major transportation element, you know, for states. But in places where they have invested, like North Carolina, like Virginia, and have increased frequencies and made the system more efficient, more effective, and more frequent, people are using it. People are traveling on it. And so Virginia is a great example where we have the I-95 corridor chronically congested. There are only so many highway style investments that are going to be made to address that congestion. And rail is a very effective option there. So I think what they can learn is that when you incorporate it with all of the other modes, when you invest in it properly, and when you create the right kind of partnerships, particularly with the freight railroads, it can be an effective tool for travel between major metros.
And what's kind of the selling point here, you think, for the industry? Because, you know, I'm just trying to think for myself, you know, now that I live in the Northeast consistently and I have a, you know, parents in the Baltimore, I have a brother who's in Massachusetts, I can get on an Amtrak ride and be in those places within, you know, minutes or even hours in some cases, too. And it's a very effective mode. And I think people also like the fact they can stand up and move around, unlike on airlines when you don't have that mobility option. You know, what's kind of the a selling point here for the rail industry to kind of sell the public on it?
Especially in the Northeast Corridor, I think that the selling point is that it's frequent, right? I mean, there's lots and lots of options. There's lots of trains that do run in the corridor, and so it can be convenient that way. It's convenient insofar as where it's located. You talk about places like Baltimore, Washington, D.C., New York. The stations are in the middle of the downtowns. Very, very convenient. So you're not traveling to airports far out on the suburban fringe. You think about Dulles Airport, you know, places like that are 30, 40 miles away from the downtown core. So I think those kinds of conveniences certainly make it an attractive mode. And I think it's going to be the way that we wrestle with traffic congestion here in the next coming years. It's hard to overstate the impact that the COVID pandemic has had on transportation. And we've seen that modes like public transit have declined pretty severely in many places because people are maybe work patterns are changing, residential patterns are changing, office location patterns are changing. But roadway traffic is back up and airline traffic is back up. And if those are going to be congested, folks are going to be looking for other ways to get around. We have this rail system that's built out throughout the country. And I think it's going to be greater demand for that in the future as folks are looking for more options for how they get around.
And you kind of touched on this a little bit right there, but I guess the last question is here, you know, what do you think the biggest obstacle is right now?
The biggest obstacle for rail is always that they don't own, Amtrak doesn't own the tracks, right? And so you have to compete with the freight rail companies. And it's been a okay relationship over the years. There's clearly conflicts that arise. There's not a lot of redundancy then in the system. So if there is an accident, if there is a delay on one of the tracks, it can shut down some routes for a long time. You see horror stories about that pop up all the time. And I think that's kind of the main thing, is making sure that we have that kind of redundancy and the ability to run more frequency in major places. Because again, if it's one or two trains a day and they're not very convenient, then it's not going to be a very effective tool for people.
Robert Puentes, we really appreciate your time and thanks for joining us.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick joins to discuss how the Problem Solvers Caucus is working to find a solution to raise the debt limit and how much COVID-related fraud has been committed. We take a look at the latest hearing by the House Oversight Committee. Until then, I'm Ryan Schmelz from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and foxnewspodcast.com.